Sebastian's Reef itself was a horseshoe of black coral extending more than 13 miles. Waves crested over it, breaking into almost infinite patterns of white froth, whipped into the lagoon beyond on the driving wind. John Rourke sat in the helicopter's co-pilot's seat, Emma Shaw at the machine's controls. He had been told by Admiral Hayes that a personal pilot would be available to him. When he learned the designated pilot was Emma Shaw, he'd evidently looked surprised. Asked if there was something unsuitable about Commander Shaw, Rourke had said, not at all. And she wasn't what he'd come to expect, as her usual, rather loquacious self. In khaki shirt and slacks and a blue baseball cap with her unit designation on the front, she merely sat there, staring ahead. Her only words, into her radio headset's mouthpiece, or to ask if she was passing low enough or slowly enough, or if he required an additional flyby. They'd come along the coast of Oahu, flying so close to the lapping surf that at times, Rourke could almost feel the spray when he peered out through the open bubble. They began following the reef as it first appeared, letting its course draw them inland. And now they were over the sand, crossing it quickly as they climbed, then over the high rocks beyond, these gray and black and volcanic, some in massive slabs, flat as a billiard table, others upthrusting and jagged, like the teeth of an enormous flesh-eating beast. The trees started then, so densely planted as to form a canopy almost impenetrable.
Once we're over this crest, Doctor, the ground drops off and the palm trees start.
Thank you.
In another second, the aircraft still climbing, the canopy began to break. Rourke noticed a wide path leading through the trees from the palm tree-fronted house beyond toward the sea. He consulted his map on the computer video console folded out in front of him. Rourke pressed a button and superimposed the map image over the ground image below, the altitude compensator already adjusting image size. The name of the owners of the house, data concerning its size, etc., all appeared beneath the image. Automatically, the program moved on as they left the house behind them. He'd asked before whether or not a helicopter flyby would alarm the personnel at the suspect house. He was told that helicopter traffic here was common, and as long as they did not seem to pay particular attention to one piece of property over another, there would be nothing to arouse interest. The next house was larger than the first, mansion-sized, a small helipad in the front yard, a chopper only marginally smaller than the military aircraft in which they flew, tethered there. Several private automobiles were in a parking area near a large garage beyond, and then they were past the house.
I think that's the house, Doctor.
Indeed it was. The house itself was much larger than the previous structures, in the shape of a squared-off letter C. A fountain of considerable proportions was set in a graveled driveway, which ran through a wide grassy area dotted with palm trees. The house had two full stories and a third floor along the center, between the two legs of the C. Toward the north of the main structure was what appeared to be a guest house, a sprawling single story that was otherwise an architectural match to the main house. The driveway branched off between the main house and the guest house, leading to a garage that appeared designed to hold at least a dozen cars, a swimming pool, tennis courts, a building that his computer's video map indicated was a stable, and a wooded area. The entire compound was fenced in. Although he could have read the same thing from the screen, he remembered the colonel telling him that the house was once the home of the Trans-Global Alliance before it was moved to Switzerland about 35 years ago. It was built with enough meeting rooms, bedrooms, kitchens, and recreational facilities to handle well over 36 personnel, not to mention a staff which sometimes exceeded 50 people. Most of the staff lived in the guesthouse structure, except for those who might be required during the night, chief of security, night butler, night cook, and the like. Then, when the Alliance moved its headquarters, the place was bought by a German corporation. The helicopter arced away from the property.
If we make too much out...
I know.
He'd seen enough.
A fortress that doesn't look like one.
John Rourke spread his hands over the horizontal screen that filled the center of the planning table in the security bunker. Michael, Natalia, Annie, and Paul were here, and he felt better somehow. The Marine colonel whose security personnel John Rourke intended to utilize spoke.
What are you planning, sir?
It goes back to what we were saying earlier, Colonel. Computer-generated scenarios can be anticipated. So can military operations, because basic military operational techniques are all but universal, aren't they? I imagine that someday, if mankind is that fortunate both to survive and be in the right place at the right time, should we encounter intelligent otherworldly beings, we'd likely discover that if the concept of a military is not unknown to them, the tactics would still be similar. Now, what we want to do is the unexpected. With your permission, Colonel, I'd like to plan this out in a totally different way. We'll require surveillance, penetration teams, and a lot of luck.
John Rourke looked at the Colonel, then at Lieutenant Commander Washington.
Agreed, sir.
The facade of the building, that happened to be on Rourke Boulevard, something John Rourke tried to ignore, was of a synthetic that looked and even felt like marble. The showroom floor and walls were of the same material, a highly polished black that looked positively elegant. The showroom for Lancer Firearms reminded John Rourke of some of the elegant shops he'd seen on New York's Park Avenue when, away on business, he would hastily and guiltily shop for presents for Sarah and Michael and Annie. But rather than overpriced baubles, the Lancer showroom was the most fully equipped weapons emporium he had ever seen, reminiscent of the great gun houses like Abercrombie and Fitch or Chicago's Sundeens, the staff knowledgeable, each item displayed impeccably presented.
I am Walter Sutherland, sir. You may recognize the reproductions of many of your own firearms here, sir. Meeting you, I must say, Dr. Rourke, is an experience I shall treasure.
Walter Sutherland was a tall, very trim man, narrow shoulders accentuating his height, a receding hairline heightening the thin, bony quality of his face. Baldness had been elective for the last century or so, Rourke understood, as it was now easily corrected or prevented. He wore a dark gray turtleneck and a black suit, the jacket without lapels in the once-again popular Nehru style. All that was missing to give Walter Sutherland the image of the perfect aristocratic retail merchant were striped pants, a morning coat, and a white carnation in the lapel.
Whew! Your facility is magnificent.
I would love you and your entire family to come and tour our manufacturing facilities just outside the city.
I'd really enjoy that. And I'll surprise you one day and turn up on your doorstep. You have no idea how pleasant it is for a man of my era to be able to find something like this.
Although everything was a reproduction, of course, there were fine English doubles. Double rifles, rimfire-free pistols, single actions in all the standard and the more exotic barrel lengths, even muzzle-loading flintlock and percussion rifles and pistols. Of edged weapons, there were designs Rourke remembered, as with the guns like long-ago friends once thought lost forever. Reproductions again, the touch of Crane, Crawford, Randall, and the other great knife-makers of the 20th century was everywhere in evidence.
With our edged weapons, as with our firearms, sir, we strive to duplicate not only the design, but the materials, every nuance of construction. In some cases, we have only scanty written records to go on. The occasional photograph, but at other times we have the original weapon to measure, to test, to reproduce. We do our humble best.
John Rourke stared into the case of Detonics 45s. He looked up from the case and into Sutherland's face.
Your humble best, Mr. Sutherland, is peerless.
Would you care to examine?
John Rourke only smiled. He now understood the meaning of the old expression, happy as a kid in a candy store.
Of course.
While Mr. Sutherland and John talked guns, Natalia merely inspected the cases. They had come here not for recreational purposes, although indeed it was pleasant, but to pick up whatever additional firearms they might require for the upcoming operation. She was not terribly taken with the modern firearms, either the caseless cartridge weapons or the energy weapons. Certainly these had their applications, and her taste in weaponry had always been eclectic, but she was wedded to the older guns, those from her own epoch. She remembered a story John had told her once concerning the near-legendary Western gunfighter Wild Bill Hickok. Long into the cartridge era, Hickok clung to his cap-and-ball revolvers, usually 1851 Navy Colts. At the time, she had failed to understand why a man of such consummate skill at arms would reject the new in favor of the old. But John had told her that story over 6 centuries ago. In the case before which she now stopped was the weapon she'd sought, her favorite large-capacity 9mm pistol.
May I show you something, Major?
She looked up into the face of a man who seemed almost cut from the same mold as his superior in the company's hierarchy, Mr. Sutherland.
Yes, the Sig Sauer P226, please.
Certainly, madam.
He began to open the case. John Rourke had finished his tour of the showroom.
I understand that you and your family have some requirements. The government has offered to pay us, of course, but I would consider it a personal privilege to provide what you might need, in exchange for a small favor.
John Rourke looked at him.
Yes?
I would like the opportunity, at your convenience, of course, and under your eye, as it were, to examine your Detonics combat masters. We have duplicated the various Colt semi-automatics and the Detonics Scoremasters and Service Master, And we've tried with the combat masters, but I've never quite felt we had the details properly in mind, with no actual firearm to work from.
John Rourke drew back the sides of his battered brown leather bomber jacket, exposing the twin stainless Detonix 45s in their double Alessi shoulder rig.
At your convenience, sir. After this matter at hand.
Oh, certainly, I understand. Now, what can I help you with?
John Rourke began walking along the showroom floor again. He stopped before a wall display.
The 12-inch barreled Remington 870 witness protection shotgun with a pistol grip.
With the fold-down 4-end piece?
No, a bit too bulky, I'm afraid.
Rourke walked on, stopping again.
And, my Steyr Mannlicher SSG is in storage in a safe house at Eden City. I'm afraid I'll be without it for a time.
I wish we could help you, Doctor, but we...
Would you like to make one?
I'd.
After I've retrieved it, you can borrow it if you like.
Sutherland's eyes positively beamed.
But I fail to see what we could provide.
Rourke nodded his head toward the wall display.
Is that HK-91 an accurate duplicate internally?
Oh, to the last detail, sir. Two of the originals were discovered 20 years ago in an abandoned survival bunker in Montana. I'm afraid they were smuggled out of Eden. I wish we had available one of the sniper versions of the G3, but none has turned up. Not yet, at least.
If the 91 requires trigger work, can you perform it?
Certainly, sir.
Rourke nodded.
We have some fine scopes. Kale, Schmidt, and Bender.
I'll prefer the iron sights with the proper ammunition.
Then Rourke walked toward one of the several display cases given over to fighting knives.
Ah, this is a reproduction of the OSS sleeve knife of H.G. Long of England, produced for the American firm E.K., isn't it?
Indeed it is, Doctor.
Then if I may, I'd like it. But I would be more than happy to pay for these items. I'm told that I have 125 years of Brigadier's General pay and allowances banked away from me at interest. And you can still bar the guns.
No, sir. I insist. Consider this our way of saying thank you to you, sir, for what you have done and what I suspect you are about to do.
Try.
There is one thing.
Certainly.
Your knives. I've read about them. The Crane knife and the A.G. Russell knife. I would love to duplicate them.
Consider them available whenever you like. Again, following our immediate business.
It was marvelous how some images stuck in the mind. All the while John Rourke paced the balcony area outside the security offices, he kept expecting to see the actor Jack Lord, or at least someone who looked like him. Because the raid on the former Transglobal Alliance headquarters, now a private home at Sebastian's Reef, was taking place in a civilian area, the Honolulu police were being brought in to assist. Although Sebastian's Reef was on the far side of the island, it was administered by the city of Honolulu. Rourke thought that a fine idea. But at the back of his mind, as he looked through the picture window dominating the entire balcony and onto the grounds where military and civilian personnel went their ways, he kept expecting to hear a craggy voice from behind him telling a young assistant to book a just-busted felon. Rourke didn't share his observations with the Marine colonel who was in charge of security, or with anyone else at the moment either. Television programs from more than six centuries ago weren't frequent topics of conversation. Rourke was already turning around. The man he saw was a vigorous-looking late 50s or early 60s. With a life expectancy these days of around 100 years, being in one's 50s or 60s wasn't anywhere near old. The man was about 5'9" or so, broad-shouldered, barrel-chested, and stocky. His face had the map of Ireland all over it.
You're Dr. Rourke. What a pleasure, sir.
The man extended his right hand, and John Rourke took it.
I'm Inspector Shaw. Tim Shaw, Doctor. I command Honolulu's tactical squad.
The pleasure's mine, Shaw. Any relation to a pilot, Commander Emma Shaw?
Tim Shaw grinned, white teeth flashing, his florid cheeks a little more florid looking for the moment.
My daughter. Not only a damn fine pilot, but a looker too. Emma's my girl.
You should be very proud of her, Inspector.
Tim, please.
John, then.
John? Are you going to be in on this, John?
The meeting, definitely. The raid, too. It'll be good to have you and your people with us. I view this as a police-style operation rather than a classic military job.
Then before we go inside, maybe you should fill me in a little. I was told there was a joint operation coming up, all on the sly, because it was top secret, and to get my rear end over here.
Here's the job as I see it, Tim. We have Martin Zimmer, the leader of Eden, a prisoner here.
Whoa!
Yeah, exactly. My son, and myself for that matter, bear a remarkable resemblance to Martin Zimmer.
Should I read something into that, John?
Well, it's a long story, but Martin Zimmer is also my son. I'll explain it when there's time. Suffice to say, my son Michael can pass for Martin. He got away with it in Eden City itself.
And?
We're gonna try for a repeat performance, only this time with backup. We're gonna let it out that Martin is on the island and has escaped. The people we're after will try to pick him up. We'll already be on alert for him, possibly.
Who are these people?
Saboteurs sent by Eden. Some of them, or all of them, SS personnel. Martin's government works hand in fist with the Nazis. These guys will be tough, well set with weapons, and not afraid to use them. We know where they're at. The old Trans-Global Alliance estate on Sebastian's Reef.
That place is built like a fort.
Exactly why we need an inside man, my son Michael. He's agreed to do it, perhaps a little too readily, but son of a bitch, he's a game guy. The idea behind the raid is to nail these saboteurs before they can do their jobs. There's an attack planned on the island in general, and Pearl Harbor in particular. We don't know when, but likely it'll be soon. So we want whatever documents, computer disks, anything that'll be of intelligence value, just as much as we want the men themselves. I don't know if there's a drug problem these days. I'd assume there isn't.
It's called Starlight. It's a fast, dirty, synthetic hallucinogenic, highly addictive. Guess where it's made?
Eden?
You got it.
My point is, I see this thing like a drug raid, all right? No good to get the guides if you don't get the stuff, too. Unless the law has changed a lot.
I don't know how much has changed or not, Doctor, but if we don't nail them with the shit on them, we don't have a case.
Then you know exactly where I'm coming from. I'm sorry to hear that drugs are still a problem, or a problem again, however you look at it. But we have to get in there. Hopefully, get some of these guys alive. Another reason I'm looking for a police-style raid rather than a military assault. We'll have Lieutenant Commander Washington Seals.
Grant's a good man. His guys and our guys train together sometimes.
Now that'll be good. Let's go in.
Should I look surprised when you...
No.
He could sleep later, he told himself. And just in case he did die, a good memory would be better than a good rest. Michael slipped between Natalia's thighs, her arms enfolding him.
I love you, Michael.
His lips touched her throat, her head leaning back. Her hair, it was such a dark brown that it was almost, in defiance to nature, a true black. Longer now than it had been when she was a grown, very mysterious woman, and he was a very confused little boy. She was the most beautiful woman he had ever seen. Counting living people, ones in videotaped movies, better than anyone. And now, because of the way his father had manipulated the cryogenic chambers, even though she was born nearly 2 decades before him, he was a nominal 2 years older than she. He had understood, as he grew to manhood in the retreat, his sister, his only companion, the nature of his father's plan. This woman was for him, from the elemental, practical consideration that the human race, should no life survive outside the retreat, would require perpetuation, and healthy babies did not come from a confined genetic pool. Natalia was for him, as Paul was for Annie. In Paul and Annie's case, there was genuine love, from the first time they saw each other as adults and before. Michael would watch his sister as she watched Paul. It was more than his father's planning. She loved Paul then, even before they had ever met as adults. He, on the other hand, had rejected loving Natalia. And then suddenly, a wife, later a mistress, it happened. Instead of coming to Natalia as a boy, who by design had grown into manhood, he came to her as a widower, a man who had been with 2 women, fathering a child, who died, by 1. He simply realized he loved her, had all the time, and she loved him. At first he had wondered if he were a mere substitute for his father, John more rigidly moral than he perhaps, but certainly committed to a wife. And then John Rourke was near death, gone from them for what could have been forever, and not because John Rourke was no longer on the scene, but because of their commonly felt loss, he and Natalia were drawn to each other. And it happened. As her thighs closed tightly around him and her body moved beneath him, something else happened.
I love you.
It might be the last time he ever had the chance to say it. John Thomas Rourke had tried the 2 new firearms on the base range, and he was satisfied that these replicas were so close to the originals on which they were based as to be identical. He realized he did not even think of them as replicas, but rather as what they were intended to be, The HK-91 was always his preference in a semi-automatic rifle, but in the days before the night of the war, he had chosen the CAR-15 because of ammunition, magazine, and parts compatibility with the military-issue M-16. This was no longer a consideration. The HK-91 was no match for the Steyr-Mannlicher SSG as a sniper rifle, but for practical accuracy in a battle rifle, it was as good as any and better than most. He had no desire for the selective fire version. In the field, in the absence of supply trains, automatic weapons ate up too much ammunition. The little 12-inch barreled Witness Protection 870 was a gun he had used, really only borrowed, on several occasions in the past. Nearly small enough to conceal as well as a long-barreled handgun, it was ultimately deadly in the proper hands at close range. He had chosen these two firearms to add to his permanent battery, based not only on his needs for the impending raid, but on a future that, if he lived long enough, he knew would take him back to Eden, perhaps even to Eden City. To restore real life to Sarah, he had to get to Dietrich Zimmer. His motto had always been, plan ahead. And yet beyond the moments when Sarah was restored and he executed Dietrich Zimmer and Martin Zimmer, eradicating their evil, he did not plan. He knew his wife well. She would never accept as fact that Martin, the baby she had born and nearly died over, was irredeemable and perforce had himself to die. And she would never forgive him. And he thought, he tried not to, about the other sleeper and why he slept. Wolfgang Mann. Annie dressed for her part. Costuming was not elaborate, but she didn't like it. Longer skirts were comfortable. The wind could do what it liked. One could sit however one wished. But she was supposed to look unnoticeable, a woman's principal advantage in this work, as Natalia always said, so she had to dress the part. In these times, the typical woman of her age wore what she was wearing now. She looked at herself in the mirror. Paul stood behind her, and she didn't want to look at his face, just in case he laughed at her. She wore a gray sleeveless dress with a round collar, but its skirt barely covered her crotch. Her stockings, textured to produce a pattern of rosebuds, were black. Her boots, rising toward her shins, were white, high-heeled, plastic. The only place she could hide a weapon was in her purse, and only one gun and a knife. She chose the Scoremaster 45 for the 45 ACP's authority over the larger capacity of her 9mm Beretta.
Whew, you look sexy.
She turned to face him, not knowing what to say.
But I like you better the way you normally dress.
Michael Rourke had never driven an ordinary car. A truck, yes, various tanks, and even staff cars that had all-terrain capabilities, but never an ordinary passenger car. This one was electric, which was what most private ownership vehicles were these days. He drove the car down a wide, palm-lined street toward a place that was named after a dour-faced black naval officer from 125 years ago. Maybe Mr. Sebastian, if there was a heaven, would watch out for him in this place that bore his name. Maybe. Video screen billboards showed his picture, actually Martin's picture, warning people in English, German, which he could read slightly, and Chinese, which he could not read at all, to be on the lookout for this dangerous armed fugitive, not naming the fugitive at all. That would have been awkward, since the real Martin Zimmer was the head of state of a foreign power of considerable influence. He drove the car along the palm-lined drive that followed the coastline, taking it toward Sebastian's Reef. He wore only one electronic device, that, rather cleverly, he thought so at least, concealed within the skeletonized belt holster for his supposedly stolen energy pistol. Once the pistol was drawn from the holster, the beeper would begin to transmit. He had little faith in the energy pistol's effectiveness in any event, and had no intention of drawing it until he needed to activate the signal. Reholstering would have no effect on the signal. It would still transmit. He was counting on being disarmed when he encountered the saboteurs at Sebastian's Reef. If he were not, he would discard the weapon and be able to get away with it, since it was contrary to Martin Zimmer's behavior patterns to go armed. Michael Rourke kept driving. John Rourke's eyes followed the terrain below them, the coastline, white surf edging brilliantly blue waves. His ears followed Emma Shaw's words.
All six helicopters are ready to go at the moment they're called up. One of the six is specially equipped to handle bomb disposal, should that be necessary.
Their explosives shouldn't be armed. Hey, your father seems like a nice guy.
He is. You'll have to meet my brother. In fact, you will. He's on Dad's TAC team.
What's his name?
Eddie. But if you call him that, he'll get all bent out of shape. He likes Ed. Thinks it sounds more manly or something.
There used to be a television show about a talking horse named Ed.
A talking horse?
Yeah, just one of the many cultural highlights of 20th century civilization, Emma. There was even a talking car who was somebody's mother come back from the dead.
My mom died when I was 12.
So you, wound up mothering your dad and your brother?
Something like that. You've got two fine kids, Michael and Annie.
Two fine ones, one rotten one, Martin.
I hope you work this out. I mean, I don't know.
I don't think Martin's gonna wake up some morning and decide to change his life, if that's what you mean. He's a racist, he's totally ruthless in his treatment of people, women in particular, it seems. And he's obsessed with the acquisition of power. That's closer to a description of Hitler than Albert Schweitzer, I'm afraid.
He was that doctor who went off into the jungles and helped the natives. Started the Nobel Prize?
No, if memory serves, he received it once. The Nobel Prize was started because Alfred Nobel, the inventor of dynamite, was bent out of shape, as you put it a moment ago, about the idea that his brilliant invention was being used to make war.
You know a lot.
Just different stuff. Actually, I'm a doctor of medicine, but I couldn't practice it today if I tried. If this is ever over, I'll have to remedy that.
Then Rourke took his eyes from the coastline and looked at Emma Shaw.
What about you? What are you going to do after you get your 20? Or is it 30 these days?
Oh, it's still 20, but you can do 30. Some people do 40. I don't know. Maybe teach people how to fly. I don't know, really. I hear that in China there's a lot of opportunity for private aviation. The country's so vast and there's so few roads.
Yeah, it sounds like it'd be fun.
Yeah, it does. What I, said when we were,
Don't worry about it.
Oh, but I meant it.
Rourke just looked at her. Emma no longer looked at him, but continued speaking, her voice coming into his ear through the headset he wore.
I mean, I know you'd never give it a second thought, but I had to say it.
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
And he understood how she meant that. John Rourke watched Tim Shaw's face as the tac team leader spoke into the microphone of his headset.
Ed, you got everybody in a position? Over.
Rourke could not hear the incoming.
All right. As soon as we get the signal, we move into ready position. Remember, be quick. Shaw out.
Lieutenant Commander Washington stepped in at the back of the truck.
My people are in place, Inspector.
You going then?
On my way.
I'm joining you. Tim, hold a good thought.
Shaw nodded as Rourke caught up his windbreaker and slipped it on over the Aloha shirt and the weapons, then stepped out into the mid-morning sunlight. Washington wore civvies, blue jeans, and a sweatshirt. Rourke fell in beside him as they left the truck, a power company repair van, and started across the street toward the car. The car, an Edison 7, was electric, reminiscent in shape to a much streamlined Corvette, low and flat at the nose and stubbed off at the rear end. He had been told it would top 100 easily. They stopped beside the car. A cool wind was blowing in off the ocean, less than a mile distant from here, but the sun itself felt warm on Rourke's face and hands. Washington extended his hand.
Good luck, Doctor.
You guys take it easy.
Then John Rourke opened the door of the car and dropped behind the wheel. There was no key, just a start code combination. Rourke touched his foot to the accelerator and pulled away from the curb. Michael Rourke pulled up to the gates. Video cameras, very small, moved into position. He watched them. The gates opened. Michael Rourke drove the little electric car through the opening. He watched in the rearview mirror as the gates closed behind him. Natalia stepped out of the car, her legs looking impossibly long with the super short skirt and thigh-high boots. Annie got out of the car as well. The hood latch release was already pulled, and they both walked to the front of the car and together elevated the hood, looking inside the engine compartment. There was a smallish power plant, so small it would have fit into a large shoulder bag. There were two batteries, these about the size of standard automotive batteries, like the one on the truck at the retreat. There was nothing wrong with the car, but from a distance, nobody would know that. Annie sneaked a look over her shoulder. Across the street were the gates leading into the compound's main driveway. If the two-stranded women in short skirts routine worked, Annie knew, those gates might open. Paul Rubenstein pushed himself up and began to move through the woods that were just beyond the northernmost fence line of the estate. Police Sergeant Ed Shaw was beside him. The rest of the tac team personnel spread out in the trees on both sides of them, The Schmeisser was tight in Paul's hands, but he thought of Michael. Less than 30 seconds ago, Edshaw's father called on the radio.
We have the signal, and it's strong. Move to ready position now. Move to ready.
That the signal was strong meant Michael was inside. That the signal was activated meant the gun Michael wore was withdrawn from its holster, either by Michael or by someone else. The fence line was barely in sight. Before they reached it, they would stop again and wait, because there were video cameras surrounding the property. At the moment Paul Rubenstein, Sergeant Ed Shaw, and the Honolulu tech team approached within range of the cameras, the estate had its own power generator, so there was no way to kill the power to the cameras. The thing would be started. Inside his thin black leather gloves, they were real leather, not one of the modern synthetics, Paul Rubenstein's hands sweated. Natalia's earrings were large. The left one was particularly heavy, being a receiver. She heard the voice of Inspector Shaw.
Stew is in the pot. I say again, the stew is in the pot.
Natalia stood up, no longer looking into the engine compartment. She smoothed down what little there was of her skirt with the tips of her fingers. Annie looked into her eyes.
Michael's inside.
Annie licked her lips and her face went a little pale. John Rourke pulled the little receiver out of his ear and flung it down on the seat.
Michael.
John turned down the relatively narrow street. Natalia and Annie were clearly visible, standing beside the upraised hood of their car. John pulled over in front of them and shut off the engine. Natalia and Annie were trying to look slinky as they waved to him. John caught a glimpse of himself in the driver's side sport mirror. The life mask that was constructed over his face, the blonde hair dye and the blonde mustache, the contact lenses to change eye color, it all worked. He didn't look like John Rourke. He turned, looking at Natalia and his daughter.
What is the problem, girls?
Our car. It just died.
Let me take a look.
And he didn't even look at the gates. It was showtime. Michael Rourke walked along a narrow corridor. The walls and ceiling, made of marble or something that resembled it, antique-style light fixtures hung along its length at regular intervals. Six men walked with him, two in front, two behind, and one on either side of him. They should have been more impressed that he was Martin Zimmer, should have treated him more deferentially. When they searched him, taking the stolen energy pistol, they were almost rude to him. As Michael neared the end of the corridor, there was a set of double doors resembling real wood. He had a disturbing thought, a very disturbing thought. Kronberg managed to sabotage teams for the SS. What if once Kronberg learned that Martin Zimmer was taken to Hawaii, he had told his people, quietly of course, that Martin should die? A sick feeling started in the pit of Michael Rourke's stomach. He lied to himself that it was because he hadn't had much for breakfast. John Rourke stared up into the nearest video camera. The sun felt positively hot. The camera turned toward his face.
I was wondering if it would be possible to have some assistance.
He didn't say anything else, just stared into the camera.
This is a private residence. You are trespassing.
I am standing in your driveway. This is trespassing?
This is a private residence. You are trespassing.
Is this the way you treat all your visitors in your glorious Hawaii? You would not be treated in such a manner in New Germany, I assure you. I require assistance for the two young women on the other side of the street.
Use your car phone.
All I require is a pair of pliers. Yes? Then I can fix the Fraulein's car. Yes?
Use your car phone to call for assistance.
No.
What do you mean, no?
These young women have been waiting here for quite some time. You did not notice them, huh? I drive a rented automobile. There are no tools. The Fraulein's have no tools in their car either. You will allow me the use of a pair of pliers, I think. Or I will stand here.
Stand the fuck in the street, but get off the driveway, or we will call the police.
Then call the police, and I will call the embassy. I will call the newspapers and the television stations. Let us see how much privacy you have then, huh?
There was no response. John Rourke stood his ground. Michael Rourke was led through the doorway, the doors opening automatically. He imagined they were controlled by some sort of electronic eye apparatus. Too much was electronic these days, he reflected. Beyond the doorway was a large desk. There were several computer and video screens arrayed on it, a central control panel, and behind the desk, a solitary man. He stood up.
Zimmer, this is a true honor, sir.
What is the meaning of this? I demand these ruffians be dismissed and...
The man behind the desk was backlit by the window. Michael couldn't see his face. Michael Rourke didn't think the situation was shaping up to be funny at all.
Once we get the signal from Dr. Rourke, Mr. Rubenstein, we'll move. Hang in there.
Jamming the video signal's gonna buy us about 60 seconds at best.
They'll know they've been penetrated, or at least suspected, but not by how many. Their motion detectors won't be sensitive enough to give them any numbers. But we should pull most of their security attention to the rear of the property so Dr. Rourke and the others can do their number.
This sucks.
Helicopters would have been spotted as they came in. The high-altitude overflight photos the Navy arranged for, and the video taken when Emma Shaw flew John near the place, indicated a sophisticated aerial surveillance net around the place. The security here was extraordinarily good, and the plan was built around turning the security system against itself rather than attempting to disarm it or get around it, both of which would have been impossible. Six choppers were waiting, but would not go up unless he or John gave the word, all in the name of diplomacy. Since Martin Zimmer's face was not generally known outside the leadership circle of Eden, it could be argued that when the Rourke family brought him to Hawaii, it was not realized he was a foreign head of state. The raid on the compound could be written off as overzealous police work in response to a tip. Even Lieutenant Commander Washington and his SEAL team personnel were in civvies, all of them armed with false Honolulu PD TAC team credentials. Once concrete evidence, which could be taken to Transglobal Alliance headquarters in Switzerland, was found in the house, and the intended sabotage could be proven, then the military could act. Diplomatic concerns would go by the board. Paul Rubenstein hoped that Michael Rourke would be safe.
You are still standing in the driveway!
Americans may be rude, but God in Himmel, they are so, so perceptive.
This is the last time I will ask you to leave.
They're good. Then you will bring me the pliers, yes?
All right, damn it.
Danke.
Michael was made to sit in a chair facing the light on the opposite side of the desk. The man's face became visible as he stepped away from the window, crossing the room toward a small bar on the far wall. The room itself was luxurious in the extreme, or seemed so at least. Aside from the large video screens on the wall flanking the bar, it could have been a 20th century boardroom or something like it, judging by the video movies Michael had seen at the retreat and descriptions he'd read of such places in books. When the man reached the bar, he turned around. Now Michael could see his face. He almost wished he couldn't. The face, deeply suntanned, was so skinny that it appeared skeletal, the eyes bulging slightly. The lips, thin and long, were drawn back over stark white teeth.
Oh, Martin Zimmer, leader!
The man's right hand shot forward in a Nazi salute.
Oh, you strutting fool. Did you think that the SS would follow such as you? You have walked into your own death, I am afraid. Have a drink, yes? You may not remember me, Herr Zimmer, but we did meet once in Eden City. Gruppenführer Kronberg introduced us, if memory serves. You drank vodka.
With that, he set down the decanter from which he'd just poured, then took an ordinary bottle filled with clear liquid. He twisted open the cap and poured into a second glass.
I am Sturmbannführer Luther Schmidt.
He walked back across the room, his long-legged stride easy, confident. He extended the hand holding the glass of vodka. Michael took it.
Toast then, Herr Zimmer, to the new Reich and to its new leadership.
Michael didn't raise his glass. He studied the surface of the liquid, then Schmidt's dark, penetrating eyes. There was laughter in them.
You will be shot to death with an American weapon, of course, and left to be found. The Americans will be charged with causing the death of Eden's beloved leader. The people of Eden, the party membership, all mourns this tragic death. All will be united in their resolve to take revenge against the Transglobal Alliance. You will be of greater benefit to our ultimate victory in your death than would ever have been possible in life for you.
Would it do any good to...
To beg?
No, just to remind you that you'll never get away with this. I know what I'm talking about.
Oh, Herr Zimmer. Oh, please.
Michael Rourke decided he was definitely in trouble. John Rourke saw the car, more like a 20th century golf cart in size, moving along the driveway, a lone man sitting in it. Rourke glanced across the street toward Natalia and Annie.
Fräulein, if you would take the pliers from this fellow, I will begin to make the repair.
Rourke left the street side of the driveway and crossed over, aware that the surveillance cameras probably still had him in view. Natalia was already walking toward the gates. They passed each other in the middle of the street.
Here we go.
Natalia walked past as if nothing had transpired between them. Her thoughts were on Michael. She told herself that if he were in immediate danger, Annie would have known somehow. She watched as the golf cart-sized vehicle began to slow, nearing the fence. Natalia stepped closer to the fence, hunching her shoulder so her cleavage would deepen. The golf cart stopped. The man, he was in his middle 20s or so, blonde, blue-eyed, muscular, and tanned under a short-sleeved white-knit shirt, stepped out.
Where's the German?
Evidently, his question was answered as she followed his eyes across the street.
I guess you get these.
He moved nearer to the fence, the pliers in his hand. He was visibly armed, a shoulder holster with some small pistol in it under his left arm. The pliers were in his right hand.
You're just so nice to help us.
Natalia smiled.
He was making himself a pain in the ass, girly. Here.
He extended the pliers through the fence. Natalia did two things. She twisted the ornament on the strap of her purse, sending a radio signal to Paul and the tech team to activate the jamming of the video security system, then grabbed the blonde man's wrist with her right hand and jerked him toward her. So his face slammed into the fence. Her left hand twisted behind her, freeing the suppressor-fitted PPKS from the small of her back, its safety already off. John Rourke slammed down the hood on the car that Natalia and Annie drove, then ran for his own car. He threw open the driver's side door, then jumped behind the wheel. Behind him, in the rearview mirror, he saw Annie already behind the wheel of the other car, which started into motion. In about a second, he'd know if the Edison 7 had any guts or was just a pretty face. Natalia stabbed the detonator into the plastique and ran, the remote that would activate it in her left hand, her PPKS in her right. John's car was in high-speed reverse down the street, while Annie was making a three-point turn. Natalia, in the middle of the street, pushed the button on the remote. Paul Rubenstein and Ed Shaw reached the fence simultaneously, three of the tech team men activating the tactical ascender. It was similar to a ladder, but the rungs were more like actual step treads, segmented, pneumatically operating. As the ladder segments shot upward, the entire mechanism leaned forward, supports folding out automatically in front, supporting the ascender. Shaw started up the treads, Paul Rubenstein behind him. The platform was already folding out from the top. Once they reached the platform, they would jump. Schmidt had a gun, one that Michael Rourke respected. The gun, most likely a Lancer reproduction, but identical in appearance to a Walther P-38K 9mm Parabellum, was pointed at his head. The six men who had accompanied him into Schmidt's office were running to their posts. Michael Rourke figured he had nothing to lose. He jumped toward Schmidt and the gun. John Rourke stomped the Edison 7's accelerator pedal to the floor. From the hedgerow on both sides of the drive, energy weapons began firing.
Shit.
He cut the wheel left toward the hedgerow. In the rearview mirror, he could see Annie and Natalia's car crashing through the same opening in the hedge. The grassy strip between the two driveways was dry and hard. He was able to steer the Edison 7 toward the fountain at the far end of the strip in the arc of the horseshoe driveway. Michael Rourke's left hand was over the Walther P-38K. His right hand balled into a fist. Michael's left hand stung, his flesh caught in the slide. He started to reach for the pistol, but Schmidt's left caught him in the abdomen. Schmidt's hands grabbed for Michael's left hand and wrist. Schmidt turned around, flipping Michael forward into a roll, throwing him hard to the floor. Michael rolled, getting to his feet, throwing his left shoulder with the full force of his weight against his opponent's chest. The Walther flew from Schmidt's right hand. Michael's left fist hammered upward, catching Schmidt under the jaw. Schmidt's right knee smashed upward. Michael lurched forward and downward, his left elbow arcing across Schmidt's face.
Damn you, Zimmer!
I'm not Zimmer, asshole! I'm Michael Rourke!
Schmidt's left fist seemed to come from nowhere. Schmidt was up. His right foot snapped out. Michael caught the ankle and rolled. Michael groped upward with his right hand, grabbing part of Schmidt's left ear, then ripping. Then Schmidt was up. Schmidt's left hand moved, and suddenly there was a knife in it.
Like a rock! Senta!
The Edison 7 skidded, its rear end fishtailing right, the car sliding broadside through the hedge at the far end of the greenway and into the arc of the horseshoe-shaped driveway. The car skidded sideways toward the fountain that was at the approximate midpoint between the hedgerow and the steps leading into the building. John Rourke hurled himself out as he grabbed for the rifle case beneath the seat. He hit the gravel hard, going into a roll. John Rourke's right hand snaked crossbody, snatching one of the twin stainless Detonics miniguns from the double LSE shoulder holster. There were three men on the steps now, one of them falling down dead, the second and third running back inside the building. Rourke safed the pistol as he got to his feet, shoving the .45 into the waistband of his trousers while he unlimbered the HK-91. He was up, running toward the car. He ducked behind the car, at an angle to the house, so any projectiles fired toward him would have the maximum amount of metal to penetrate before reaching him. As Schmidt's knife arced outward and downward, there was nothing else Michael could do but block it with his left forearm. As the blade crossed his flesh, Michael Rourke's right hand snapped forward, inside his opponent's guard, the heel going for the base of Schmidt's nose. Schmidt still held the knife. Michael's left forearm was drenched with blood, and he could not take another cut like that. His face a bloody mask, Schmidt charged forward, the knife held high in a rapier hold, aimed for Michael's chest. Michael Rourke waited. At the last second he dared, he dropped right, Michael's legs scissoring outward. He was near the bar. The decanter. It looked like real glass, not synth glass. Schmidt was on his feet. Holding the knife as he had before, he charged. As Schmidt came for him, Michael sidestepped, swinging the bottle of vodka outward and toward Schmidt's head. Michael was losing consciousness, the pain in his left arm incredible now. His right hand swept outward. Schmidt's right hand still held the knife, driving it upward for Michael's abdomen. Michael's right hand arced right to left. The jagged base of the whiskey decanter slashed across Schmidt's throat. Michael's body was carried on his own momentum, and he started to fall, a wash of darkness flooding over him. Paul Rubenstein ran dead out, Ed Shaw and the other tech team personnel surrounding him.
Drop! Drop!
Paul threw himself down to the ground, the others around him doing the same, returning fire to the rear of the house. On their immediate right were the stables, a large exercise corral beside it. Between the stables and the house lay the enormous garage he'd seen in the aerial photos. Gunfire came from the deck on the near side of the garage as well. They were pinned down. He activated the signal, calling in the unmarked helicopters with Lieutenant Commander Washington's civvy-clad SEAL team aboard. Annie Rubenstein hit the brakes. Beside Annie, Natalia was already pulling on a flak jacket as she slid out the passenger side, Annie sliding out the same way after her. Annie grabbed her flak jacket from under the back seat cushion, the jacket longer than her miniskirt. Under the seat cushion as well were two of the short-barreled German assault weapons. Natalia handed her one, along with a musette bag loaded with magazines.
Ready. You'll take the left, I'll take the right.
Annie was up, running as fast as she could with the stupid-looking boots and her higher-than-normal heels, almost stumbling in the gravel driveway. But she reached the steps on the right side. As she looked, Natalia was on the left side. They gave each other a nod, then started off, Annie following the building's perimeter along the right side. John Rourke made a decision. There was a heavy concentration of gunfire coming from the rear of the house. If Paul hadn't already called in added personnel, he would. He activated the signaling device that was clipped to his belt. Diplomacy be damned. Rourke moved along the wall of the large entrance hall, rectangular in shape, the ceiling extending upward through the second floor. A balcony traversed it from one side of the house to the other, and as Rourke looked, he saw movement on the near side. He tucked back into a doorway opening, checking on the inside as he did. A man's shape appeared from behind an overturned table. The movement he had seen a second before along the balcony appeared to be three men, clearly visible now, running from the near side of the balcony toward the other side of the second floor. Rourke had the HK-91 to his shoulder and fired. Michael Rourke was lightheaded and sick from the loss of blood. With some difficulty, he rolled onto his side, keeping his left arm elevated in that manner, hopefully slowing the flow. His trousers were beltless, the plastic holster he'd worn for the miserable little energy pistol a clip-on style. He wore a t-shirt and a windbreaker, no tie.
Shit!
His eyes traveled to the dead body lying beside him. Schmidt's gun, a P-38K. Worn in a shoulder holster? Michael Rourke pushed with his feet and pulled with his right hand, dragging himself toward Schmidt's body. The Nazi's bony face had a slightly waxy look to it, but Michael realized this was mostly his imagination. Schmidt hadn't been dead that long. Michael started to reach under the blood-drenched coat to search for a shoulder holster harness, but his hand stopped. Schmidt wore a belt, easier to access and easier to utilize for his purpose. The fingers of Michael's right hand felt thick and stiff, clumsy, but he managed to undo the belt buckle. Then he braced one foot against Schmidt's chest as he pulled, freeing the belt, falling back as he did so. Michael managed to sit up, his head swimming with the sudden movement. The belt. He began to wrap it around his arm, between the wound and his heart. His arm wound now in an improvised tourniquet, Michael Rourke lurched toward the windows behind the desk. The P-38K Schmidt had used was in his right hand, a fresh 8-round magazine up the well, the partially spent one pocketed. As he parted the sheer curtains, he could see through the windows helicopter gunships coming in over the trees beyond the house. Men occupied positions of cover on a bricked patio, firing toward other men on the ground, storming toward the house. As yet, no bullet had struck these windows, but it was only a matter of time. The gun still in his hand, he rubbed his fingertips over the window. It felt like real glass. He stuffed the pistol into his trouser band and reached for the desk chair. The chair was heavy, but he convinced himself he could lift it well enough to crash it through the window. John Rourke took out the plastic explosives and set the detonator to 10 seconds, then ran back across the room, dropping behind a sofa, drawing his body up into a fetal position in order to protect bare skin. Then Rourke was up, the air in the room clouded with plaster dust, a hole in the far wall. Rourke ran toward it, the HK-91 in both hands. He saw a man getting to his feet after the explosion. Rourke advanced to the doorway, a rifle raised toward him from the door on the opposite side of the corridor. Rourke fired first. He stepped to the doorway. Rourke ran toward the sound. Michael Rourke pushed the muzzle of the P-38K through the shattered window. The defenders had turned toward the sound of breaking glass. Michael swung the muzzle of his weapon, finding another target and firing. In the hands of a third man, an assault rifle was coming online toward his body.
Get down!
Michael threw himself right. John Rourke grabbed for one of the plastic charges, flipping the detonator to 5 seconds, hurling it left-handed through the shot-out window as he ran toward his son, throwing his body over Michael's. Rourke's left hand felt for a pulse, weak but steady. Michael was unconscious, not dead. Rourke was up on his knees, the HK-91 to his shoulder. The HK was empty, and Rourke buttoned out the clipped-together magazines, letting them fall to the glass surrounding him on the floor. As he rammed one of the two remaining spares up the rifle's magazine well, two of the house's defenders charged toward him. With the rifle in his left hand, Rourke grabbed for the Detonix minigun at his waistband. Rourke rammed the pistol into his belt, the HK to his shoulder again, the chamber charged. He stepped over the window frame and down into the patio. The HK tensioned on its sling so he could fire the rifle one-handed, his second Detonix minigun in his left hand. Men were trying to escape the patio now, but there was nowhere to run. Helicopters coming in from the woods behind the house, some of Washington's civvies-clad SEAL team already out of the choppers and storming the house. More men coming. Rourke crossed the patio toward a concrete apron extending away from the house, picking up another of the light-caliber stubby-barreled German rifles. A half-dozen men were charging toward the hedgerow about 30 yards away.
Natalia!
Daddy! Natalia's over!
Cover my back!
He broke into a run. He saw Natalia on her feet behind the hedgerow, her pistol and his shotgun discharged simultaneously. Natalia stepped out from behind the hedgerow, her left arm hanging limp at her side, dripping blood, her black stockings shredded over her thighs. Natalia approached. Rourke offered her the shotgun. She shoved her pistol into the waistband of her skirt and took it. Rourke handed her 4 loose shells from his pocket. Her left arm moving slowly, she began inserting the shells beneath the action. As he turned back toward the patio, he saw Annie, her assault rifle in one hand, her pistol in the other. With both Detonix miniguns in his fists, Rourke started back to the patio. He heard Natalia racking the shotgun. Rourke turned in toward the house. A dozen or so of the men here, saboteurs sent to destroy from within to soften for the attack, still returned fire from the grounds between the patio and the garage. Lieutenant Commander Washington's men and the tech team people, all with them, Rourke knew, seemed to be everywhere. Rourke approached the house, peering through the shot-out window, then stepping over the sill.
Be careful of the broken glass.
He came upon Michael, examining him quickly but thoroughly. One major wound on his left forearm, a knife cut, tied off with a tourniquet. Blood loss, shock. Natalia, he wondered how she'd gotten over the windowsill in her short skirt, was beside him. Rourke looked at her.
He'll be okay. Find something to keep him warm. Get the medics.
Annie was trying to get through the window, but not doing a very good job of it with the broken glass all around the frame. Rourke set his pistols on the desk, reached through, and scooped his daughter up into his arms, setting her down inside the room.
Help Natalia with your brother. He'll be all right.
John Rourke picked up his pistols, then started across the room, back into the corridor. There would be a room, one special room. There always was. On the way toward the basement, he knew there was one from the architectural plans, he acquired another assault rifle and loaded the magazine, with only four rounds remaining, into the action of his HK. The entrance to the basement was not easy to find, but not all that difficult either, since from historical data concerning the house, as it was used while headquarters for the Transglobal Alliance, he knew where the interior wall should be. When he found one that should not be there, he assumed, correctly, that it masked access to the basement. After a moment, he found an electronic release and a panel open, revealing a reasonably wide stairwell going straight downward. Rourke took the stairs slowly, the twin stainless Detonics pistols, hammers lowered and chambers loaded, thrust into their holsters, the German assault rifle in his left hand, the semi-automatic HK-91 in his right. A man jumped into view at the base of the stairs, an energy pistol raised in his right hand. He reached the base of the stairs. Another man was nearly through the metal door. Rourke approached the door, kicked it inward, and stepped inside.
Step into the open! Hands in the air above your heads! Nothing in your hands!
There were two men and a woman, all of them with empty hands raised. There was a fourth person in the room, a stack of computer disks on a table in front of him.
Step away!
The man wiped a disk across the degausser as he aimed a pistol toward Rourke. There were about 20 or 30 disks on the floor, but a stack of at least 50 or 60 were still on the table. Documents were heaped in the center of the floor, but no one had set them afire yet. John Rourke looked at the walls. Maps, partially torn down. Computer terminals still showed map displays.
Will you kill us?
No.
In this room, he had what he wanted. Invasion plans, maps, lists of agents, almost certainly.
There's no reason now.
He safed the HK, letting it fall to his side on its sling. He did the same with the little German assault rifle, but set that weapon on the table near him. He drew one of the twin stainless Detonics pistols in his right hand.
You can never win. We will be victorious. Your cause is hopeless. You can never win.
We can win. You wait and see. You wait and see. We'll surprise you.
He began to tear away the life mask from his face, and he noticed the man's eyes.
It is John Rourke!
After all, he thought, he had promised a surprise. But this wasn't it.
Survivalist Brutal Conquest is a Graphic Audio production. Copyright 1991, Jerry Ahern. Published by arrangement with Jerry and Sharon Ahern. All rights reserved. Production copyright 2010, The Cutting Corporation, all rights reserved. Performed by Terrence Aselford, Nanette Savard, Eric Messner, Michael Glenn, M.B. Van Dorn, Tony Nam, Colleen Delaney, Laura Quinn Anderson, Yasmin Toison, David Coyne, Dylan Lynch, Tim Getman, Thomas Penny, Ken Jackson, M.J. Casey, and Mort Shelby. Additional red shirts by The Dead Giveaways. Directed by Johann Detweiler. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Temeskin Wubna. Book adapted for graphic audio by Johann Detweiler. If you enjoyed The Survivalist, be sure to look for E.E. Knight's Vampire Earth series, available at road stops everywhere at 1-800-670-5220 or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloadable extras, forums, and podcasts. Keep listening for a preview of another title in Graphic Audio.
Available now from Graphic Audio.
Kyler Stern has rejected the assassin's life.
We've got a contract for you. 50,000 gunders for one kill, Kyler. With that much, you can take Eileen annually anywhere. You'll have done the world a good turn, and you'll never have to work again. It's just one last job.
There's always one last job.
I'm finished.
The God King's successful coup has left Kyler's master, Derzo Blint, dead and buried.
Oh, I've been having a little party, celebrating.
What are you celebrating?
Derzo Blint is dead!
Tired of it all, he is starting over. New city, new friends, and a new profession.
Kyler, there are always going to be people so bad that we think they deserve to die. I don't know. What I do know is what you've told me about what killing has done to your soul. No matter what good it seems to do for the world, it destroys you. I can't watch that, Kyler. I won't. I care about you too much.
All right. We should be able to leave in the morning.
But the beckoning will of the Shadow soon comes to call on Kyler once again.
Logan's alive. He's in the hole.
Logan's alive?
Every day, the chances that Logan will be discovered get worse.
You want me to break into the hole and save Logan?
I want you to rescue Logan. And then I want you to assassinate the God King.
Kyler is faced with an agonizing choice. Will he give up the Way of Shadows and live in peace? Or will he risk everything by taking on the ultimate hit?
Look at yourself! I know this hit is impossible! I'm sending you after a god! But if anyone in the world can do it, it's you! You were made for this, Kyler. Some things are bigger than your happiness. You can give hope to an entire nation.
It'll only cost me everything.
Will Kyler see the light when his world is shrouded in shadows? Find out in Shadow's Edge, the thrilling second part of the Night Angel trilogy. Available now in graphic audio.
It's good to have you back, my friend.
It's bad to be back.
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220. Or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different graphic audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets, which contain up to 5 books of a series. Available only at www.graphicaudio.net. Be sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter or follow us on Twitter.